Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. Episode 278, The South African Suez Canal, Stella Land and Goshen, and the Terrible Tale of James Honey. In 1882, the German mathematician Ferdinand von Lindemann proved that pi was transcendental. It cannot be reduced to a tidy equation, never captured inside the comfortable boundaries expected by mathematicians. For centuries, mathematicians tried to square the circle, creating a perfect square with the same area as a circle using only classical tools. In 1882, they finally got their answer. It's impossible. Pi's transcendence means the problem itself can never be solved. Pi, you see, sits at the center of order, wheels, planets, architecture, engineering, but it does not obey the rules mathematicians thought would contain it. The more closely pi is examined, the more it slips beyond simple description. But pi also has beauty in its patterns. Pi, roughly 3.14765 etc., etc., is the hidden constant inside every circle. Divide the distance around any circle by the distance across it, and written out as a decimal, it goes on forever, without ever stopping, and without ever falling into a repeating pattern. Southern Africa in the early 1880s had the appearance of something similar to pi. The neat assumptions of empire borders that could be drawn, peoples classified, and territories administered into obedience were beginning to collide with the far messier reality. The aftermath of the First Anglo-Boer War had humbled imperial confidence. African polities remained powerful actors, and the mineral revolution was creating forces no colonial administrator fully controlled. Like pi, South Africa was proving resistant to simple formulas and maths. Emerging at this time was the Afrikaner Bond, led by Jan Hendrik Hofmeyr. His Boeren Beskermingsvereniging, Farmers Protection Society, had merged with the Bond. Hofmeyr's main aim was to merge the diverse Afrikaner cultural movements from behind the scenes, thus his nickname, The Mole. Cape Prime Minister John Gordon Sprigg was sparring with political humanists, particularly Saul Solomon, who owned the Cape Argus. As a liberal member of parliament, Solomon was an articulate defender of African rights, called a friend of the natives, and worse, by some settlers. He was enticed to sell his paper to the editor at the time. What he didn't know was that Cecil John Rhodes was secretly backing the sale. Now Rhodes owned the Argus. It was at that moment that the Cape lost its important outsider voice, and Rhodes gained a news outlet. The main story that paper was covering at the time, after the First Anglo-Boer War, was the instability in Basutoland. The Argus and other liberals had taken up the Basutu case against the land-hungry settlers of the Orange Free State. They didn't really need help. The Basutus were heavily armed with guns and were accomplished horse riders of the mountains. They'd never been vanquished. Furthermore, under the influence of French Protestant missionaries, the Sotho people had embraced capitalism, particularly when it came to agriculture and firearms. They managed the farms that fed Kimberley. Sotho men and women worked on the diamond fields. With the cash they earned, the Basutu bought Western-style clothing and horses and guns. Under Sprigg's leadership, the Cape Parliament had passed the Peace Preservation Act in the late 1870s, a law targeting blacks. They were supposed to surrender their guns. This was the first form of racial discrimination in Cape law, which had banned all forms of discrimination. The Basutus and many others simply ignored the law. Sprigg was on shaky ground because of the rising costs of war. With his friend Bartel Freer fired by the new British government in 1880, the knives were out for the Cape Prime Minister. The Cape's expensive campaign against Basutoland was getting in the way of developing the railroad to Kimberley. Sotho resistance on mountains and broken terrain had cost the Cape's forces dearly, sapping funds for public works like building the railways and roads. Sprigg was eventually outmaneuvered and replaced by Thomas Scanlon, who teamed up with Rhodes' allies John X. Merriman and Jan Hofmeyr. The era was awash with millionaires messing about in politics. A few other names are going to be dropped, names of significance. The year, 1882. General Charles Gordon, hero of the Taiping Rebellion in China, visited the Cape. A well-known and respected campaigner against corruption and slavery, Gordon travelled to Basutoland with the Cape forces in midwinter, arriving in August. Riding alongside him was Cecil John Rhodes. Their brief was to negotiate with the Basutu chiefs. General Gordon was well received by them, especially because he arrived at the meetings unarmed. He obtained a list of agreements and rode back to Cape Town, where his administrative arrangements promptly fell on deaf ears. So he resigned in frustration at the end of 1882 and left South Africa. Later, Gordon sent for Rhodes to join him in the Congo, where he had been hired by King Leopold of Belgium. Rhodes turned this offer down, and Gordon departed the Congo shortly afterwards anyway, when he realized just how bad Leopold's motives were in Central Africa. General Gordon ended up in Khartoum, the Sudanese capital, trying to suppress a rebellion by Islamic reformer Muhammad Ahmad bin Abdullah, short name the Mahdi. Gordon once again asked Rhodes to join him there as assistant in the Anglo-Egyptian administration. Rhodes refused, which is fortunate for the diamond magnate because Gordon was decapitated by the Mahdi. The two empire builders could have died shoulder to shoulder. Needless to say, that would have altered South African history. Back in Basutoland, the chiefs were resilient and in a position of power, demanding that London rule them directly, not the Cape. All of this didn't seem to affect the flow of Basutu labour and grain to Kimberley, which relied on both. In July 1883, Rhodes made a speech in the Cape House of Assembly referencing what he called the volcano of discontent among the settlers when it came to what he said was the disturbed country around Basutoland. Jan Hofmeyr of the Afrikaner Bond disagreed, saying Basutoland should rule itself because he didn't want the British to antagonise the Orange Free State. "I believe in the United States of South Africa," he said. Shoring up his personal wealth and power, Rhodes was simultaneously using his growing influence in the Cape to protect its northern territories. This was a natural progression. North of Kimberley lay the Vaal River and the Malopo River. Between the two lay not only the Boers of the Orange Free State and the Transvaal, but the Tswana people. South of the Malopo, there were the Tlapeng, the Rolong. North of the Malopo, the Ngwato, ruled by Khama, as well as the Nkwena under Chief Shesheli, the Ngwaketsi, ruled by Gasset Siwe, and his son, Batun. The Tswana were tussling with colonial expansion and navigating the difficult politics of the frontier, keeping the Boer settlers at arm's length. Along the edge of these chiefs' territory, there lay the Great North Road on the eastern side of the Tswana lands, the western side of the Transvaal. There, Transvaal President Paul Kruger was behind efforts to cut off the road to the north, something the British authorities suspected but couldn't prove. Part of the Boer plan was to allow expansion west and complete a railway to Lourenço Marques, to the east, the Portuguese town at Delagoa Bay. Kruger's east-west axis was part of a much larger geopolitical reality in which the claims of the Congo and Germany were growing more aggressive. Berlin was increasing its activity in Tanzania and Namibia, and the strategic road north was vulnerable. Groups of chiefs along the road had already begun to cooperate with the Boers. Others, like the Rolong and Korana, had handed over land as payment for protection and support. The Transvaal's actions were defended in the Cape Parliament by Hofmeyr's Afrikaner Bond, who said the expansion was intended to convert the interior of South Africa into settler-dominated, racially exclusive farming communities. But the founding of two small Boer republics on this road in 1882 complicated matters. The proclamation of Stellaland and Goshen irritated the colonial office in London, offending the officials, who muttered about a threat to British territorial sovereignty. The German government didn't help matters. It seemed to be encouraging the new settlers of Stellaland and Goshen. Berlin was also negotiating with the semi-autonomous Mpondo chiefdoms in the Eastern Cape near Port St. John's. In 1883, Prime Minister Scanlon appointed a parliamentary commission to investigate the Griqualand West boundary, and Rhodes was installed as one of the commissioners. After meetings, the diamond magnate came to the conclusion that the Boer residents of Stellaland and Goshen were in favour of integration with the Cape Colony. They, of course, wanted nothing of the sort. These burghers were freebooters, roamers, mercenaries, rebels. To understand how the Boers overcame the Tswana people in this region, we have to dispel the myth that it was a straightforward state-on-state military conquest. The ZAR, the Transvaal government, couldn't directly invade because their hands were tied by the 1881 Pretoria Convention borders. Instead, individual Boer freebooters Freibeuters, as they were called, and mercenaries acted as a proxy force by weaponizing existing dynastic rivalries between Tswana leaders. They divided the theater into two distinct conflicts. The Stellaland front to the south was a conflict between the Batlapeng chief Mankurwani, who was historically friendly to the British, and his rival David Massou, a Korana leader backed by the Boers. The Goshen front in the north was a conflict between the Baralong Burachidi chief Monchiwa, who was a pro-British independent, and his rival Mosweti, who was pro-Boer. The Boers entered these conflicts not as an official army, but as volunteers. The deal they made with Massou and Mosweti was simple. They promised firepower and tactical advice. In return, they'd receive land and cattle in the traditional African way. Stellaland rose first in the south. Boer mercenaries led by Gerard Jacobus van Niekerk flooded into Massou's territory. Facing modern firearms and mounted commanders, Mankurwani was slowly squeezed out of his grazing lands. By July 1882, realizing he was being beaten by proxy, Mankurwani was forced to sign away chunks of his territory in a desperate bid for peace. Van Niekerk and his men immediately staked out the ceded land, declaring the Republic of Stellaland, named after a comet which was visible in the sky at the time. Its capital was Vryburg. At the same time, Mankurwani's people were penned into tiny unsustainable reserves representing a fraction of the original land. Further north, the conflict was bloodier. The Boer mercenaries were led by a ruthless figure, Nicolaus Claudius G. van Picius. His fighters backed Mosweti against the formidable chief Mochiwa, eventually trapping Mochiwa's forces and besieging his stronghold at Mahikeng. The town fell on October 24, 1882. In the aftermath, Mosweti was forced to cede large portions of Baralong land to G. van Picius's mercenaries. Van Picius proclaimed the state of Goshen, which he named after the fertile biblical land given to Joseph, setting up a crude fortified capital at Rooigrond, right on the Transvaal border. Rooigrond was little more than a collection of mud huts and tents, but it was highly strategic. G. van Picius even designed a flag that mimicked the Transvaal Vierkleed, eventually settled on a black stripe to signal defiance, a kind of symbol of a land pirate. The Tswana did not simply roll over. In late 1883, the Baralong under Monchiwa launched a fierce counter-offensive. They secured logistic and military alliances with neighboring Dikgosi chiefs, including the Bang Waketsi and the Bakwena. By the end of 1883, the Baralong had successfully fought back, confining the Goshenite commandos right to the edge of the Transvaal border at Rooigrond. In early 1884, Monchiwa's forces actually raided Rooigrond and burned the mercenary camp to the ground. For Cecil Rhodes and British ambitions, these two micro-republics were a geopolitical nightmare. If the Transvaal annexed Stellaland and Goshen, which was Paul Kruger's ultimate goal, the Boers would completely block Cape Colony access to the interior of Africa. Rhodes had taken to calling the Great North Road the Suez Canal of South Africa. In August 1883, realizing they were vulnerable to both British pressure and Tswana counterattacks, Stellaland and Goshen merged to form the United States of Stellaland. Then a murder, most foul, changed everything. Into our story drops another of South Africa's patchwork of crazy characters, and one with a memorable name, Nogal, James Honey, a former policeman and British citizen, a classic frontier opportunist too. Educated, highly literate, he was also deeply ambitious and greedy. When the freebooters of Van Niekerk's Stellaland Boers flocked to Massou's territory to fight Mankurwani, James Honey joined them as a mercenary. Because he could write well and understood administrative structures, Gerrit van Niekerk appointed him as the secretary to the Committee of Management for the new Stellaland territory in 1882. Honey was the bureaucratic engine behind the land grabs. He was the one drawing up the titles for the stolen Tswana farms. The erudite Honey's mercenary days, however, were numbered. By early 1883, cracks were appearing within the Stellaland leadership. Van Niekerk ran the Republic like a personal fiefdom, and a faction of the freebooters, who were mostly those of British descent, felt he was corrupt and steering them towards a disastrous clash with Cape Colony interests. Honey fell out with Van Niekerk spectacularly. Recognizing that Van Niekerk was playing a dangerous game, Honey switched sides and began plotting to overthrow Van Niekerk's Stellaland administration and replace it with a government that would favour direct British annexation. Worse for Van Niekerk, Honey began secretly copying official documents, financial records, private letters, intending to hand them over to British authorities in the Cape to prove that the Stellaland government was illegal and a criminal syndicate. When Van Niekerk discovered the betrayal in February 1883, he had Honey arrested on charges of high treason, and the Brit was thrown into a makeshift jail in Vryburg. But Honey had allies among the mercenaries, and he was soon sprung. The jailbreakers burst Honey out and helped him flee south across the border into the relatively safe territory of Makurwani's Batlaping people at Taung. All drama, action, excitement must be another bit of South African history. Lurking in Taung, Honey openly defied Van Niekerk, continuing to organize opposition and threatening to expose the Republic's inner workings to the British. Van Niekerk knew Honey was a loose end that could unravel the entire Republic of Stellaland. And the Stellaland commander came to the conclusion that Honey had to be eliminated, but doing it in Tswana territory could spark a war. Instead, a trap was set. A group of Stellaland burghers, led by prominent freebooters including Martinus Groetjoen and Celestine Silius, approached Honey under a flag of truce. They claimed they wanted to negotiate a peaceful settlement and invited him back to Vryburg to clear his name. Honey was overconfident, perhaps even a bit naive about frontier brutality, and agreed to accompany them back to Stellaland. On March the 14th, 1883, while riding through an isolated, desolate stretch of the veld near the Transvaal-Stellaland border, the party stopped in more ways than one. According to later depositions of witnesses and accomplices, Honey was ordered off his horse. Realizing what was happening, he pleaded for his life, then turned to run away and was shot in the back. Groetjoen and Celiers walked over, finished him off, and buried his body in a shallow grave out there in the dusty bush. Van Niekerk naturally assumed dead men tell no tales. That may be true, but live men are full of gossip and hot air. For a couple of months after March 1883, Honey appeared to have simply vanished into the veld. Gerrit van Niekerk's administration tried to keep a lid on it, but the missing Brit had powerful literate friends. Out of the blue, on May 26th, 1883, the Diamond Fields Advertiser newspaper published a sensational detailed expose about Honey's disappearance. A rival paper, the Kimberley Advertiser, quickly picked up the scent. Both papers explicitly accused the Stellaland burghers of a cold-blooded execution. Then the press coverage blew the cover off Van Niekerk's Pisang Republic. Cape Colony readers and politicians in Cape Town realized a British subject had been murdered by an illegal gang of freebooters, gangsters, mercenaries. The main source of the information were survivors of Honey's faction, particularly Captain Frank John Wells, who had also been targeted by the Stellaland leadership to be terminated with extreme prejudice. The freebooters tried to kill him too, further implicating them in the original murder. The conspirators included a Boer named Groot Adriaan de la Rey. Captain Wells survived an attempted hit and was now extremely motivated to solve the mystery. He and Honey's brother rode out secretly into the desolate frontier to find where James had been buried. They eventually located the shallow grave in the bush near the Transvaal border. In late May 1883, they exhumed Honey's remains, and the sad vestiges of his body were brought back across the border into Kimberley on May 28, 1883. Honey's murder had the exact opposite effect because the true story emerged and horrified factions within Stellaland and outraged the Cape Colony's public. It prompted action, including an 1885 military expedition of Stellaland by British commander Sir Charles Warren. That failed in its main aim, but it did succeed in capturing Gerrit van Niekerk, who was arrested for his role in planning Honey's murder. Gerrit van Niekerk was brought to trial in a Cape court, and this is where borders and territories get confusing, because the murder had technically taken place in a legal twilight zone just outside the official Cape border, inside a disputed territory that Britain hadn't formally annexed. At the exact moment of the crime, the defence argued the Cape courts had no jurisdiction. So Van Niekerk beat the murder rap on a legal technicality, but his political career and his republic were dead. He was banished, eventually dying in oblivion. Honey's execution became a primary exhibit used by Cecil Rhodes and the British humanitarians to argue that Stellaland was an illegitimate state, an area of anarchy and malignance that required British military intervention. All of this was heating up the Brit and Boers' sentiment just in time for the discovery of gold on the Witwatersrand. Interesting times await. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platform. You can sign up for the newsletter at desmondlatham.blog. Until next, goodbye.